Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
On the outskirts of London, at Teddington, stands the National Physical Laboratory. Its newest achievement is the ACE, the protégé of a group of mathematicians. The name comes from its initials, Automatic Computing Engine.
December 1950. The headlines are dominated by the ongoing Korean War. But at the National Physical Laboratory, the staff have something to be chipper about.
To engineers and scientists in all branches of industry, the electronic brain, as some persist in calling it, will be an invaluable aid. Months of work will be reduced to minutes, thanks to the ACE.
The BBC, ahead of the game as ever, had already given listeners details of the proposed ACE computer 4 years earlier.
For a long time, mathematicians have been occupied in getting better logical foundations for their subject. And in this field, about 12 years ago, a young Cambridge mathematician by name Turing wrote a paper which appeared in one of the mathematical journals, in which he worked out, by strict logical principles, how far a machine could imitate the processes of thought. The answer can't be given simply, of course, but it's roughly that you could make a machine do anything which can be called rule of thumb.
With Headmasterly Tone, the director of the National Physical Laboratory, Sir Charles Darwin, grandson of the famous one, outlined the essence of one of the greatest leaps of mathematical imagination in the past century. And he introduced listeners to the name of the hero mathematician behind that great leap, Alan Turing. Born 100 years ago on the 23rd of June, Alan Turing established the fundamental concepts that led to the modern computers that we all use today. And yet, as you'll hear in the next two editions of Discovery, Alan Turing's core role in computing science still struggles to be recognised, partly because of his early, tragic death in 1954, and partly because much of his key work was done in secrecy. But now, back to that 1946 tutorial on Alan Turing's first conceptual model of computing.
It was an idealised machine he was considering, and at the time it looked as if it would be so fantastically elaborate that it could never possibly be made. But the great developments in wireless and in electronic valves during the war have quite altered the picture, because through complicated electric circuits you can do many more things at enormously greater speed than you could do before mechanically. Consequently, Turing, who's now on our staff, is showing us how to make his idea come true.
The Pilot ACE computer, based on Alan Turing's design, was indeed built and ran successfully until the mid-1950s, when it was replaced by a commercial version using the same plan. Under the flight path from Heathrow, the National Physical Laboratory has since changed enormously, with spectacular new glass and steel buildings springing up all round its leafy grounds. But behind them, the grand old manor house where ACE was built survives.
They've lowered the ceiling reasonably recently, so it's a bit hard to tell.
Peering in through windows, Turing expert Jack Copeland struggles to identify the room where it all happened.
But this is definitely not what I was shown as the home of the Pilot ACE.
So it's indoors we go to see if the old concert room in the house lives up to Jack Copeland's memories.
It's a beautiful room. High ceiling, lots of windows, and you can almost feel the ghost of the Pilot ACE here. We know from photographs where they built it. And there's a classic photograph of the Pilot ACE. There are these huge windows in here. And there's the Pilot ACE standing there in all its glory with sunlight streaming in through the windows. And it's like, you know, the light comes bursting in. Turing has created the information age. And here is the computer. And it's a wonderful picture. So here it would have been, the Pilot Model ACE, ran its first program in 1950.
Alan Turing's story starts long before, his mathematical talent first flowering while still a school student.
It was at Sherborne School, the first flashes of Turing's mathematical genius started to show. So he'd have been about 16 or something at this time. His maths master was Canon Donald Epperson, who died a few years ago. Epperson says that his methods were sometimes brilliant but sometimes unsound, and that Turing would sometimes take very long-winded approaches to problems because he liked to work things out for himself. And this was a feature of his work right through his life. Another of his masters said that he would donate £1 billion to charity if Turing passed his Latin exam.
The school's supercilious disdain for maths didn't impede Turing's progress, first to a scholarship at King's College, Cambridge, followed by a fellowship there at the extraordinarily young age of 22, soon after he'd graduated. And within months of that, he'd embarked on the explorations that led to his theoretical notions of a universal computing machine.
He got the ideas as a result of going to lectures by Max Newman, who later, of course, became one of his greatest friends and who he worked with closely at Bletchley Park and then at Manchester. But in 1935, Turing went along to Newman's course of lectures on the foundations of mathematics. Very difficult subject. So Newman didn't have that many students, but Turing was amongst them. Newman talked about the amazing discoveries recently made at that time by the young Austrian logician Kurt Gödel at the University of Vienna, and the whole course really sort of aimed at an exposition of Gödel's incompleteness results in mathematics.
It was while Turing was still at school that the Austrian logician Kurt Gödel, hoping to put mathematics on a solid logical foundation, discovered that, to the contrary, there are mathematical truths that can never be proved and mathematical statements that can never be tested. In logic, for example, what do you do when a stranger tells you he's a liar? Is he lying about his lying or telling the truth about it? There is no way to an answer. Alan Turing wanted to go further and see whether there were numbers that could exist and yet could never be reached by mathematical computation. It sounds bizarre, but it's only answerable when you understand first what mathematicians actually do when they calculate.
What is a computation? What things are computable? Alan Turing came up with a mathematician's version of a computer, which is called a Turing machine. It's not really the sort of machine that you make. It's the sort of conceptual machine that has all of the ingredients in the simplest way.
Turing's insight, says Professor Ian Stewart, was to realise that for all their grey matter, mathematicians pursuing a calculation just mechanically follow rules they were taught at school. For an addition, you write the numbers down on a sheet of paper to help your memory, add the first digits, carry anything over 10 to the next column, and so on. And if the written instruction is instead a cross for times or a dash for subtract, use those different rules instead. And in fact, why bother with a rectangular sheet of paper when you could resort to a narrow strip?
So Turing's idea for the memory is it's just an infinitely long tape, well, a finite tape, you can make it as long as you like. It's like a tape in a tape measure, but it's divided off into squares. And each square has either a naught written on it or a one written on it. You could do it with magnetic tape if you wanted to. Then you have to have essentially a way of inputting into the machine what you want it to do. And you have to have some sort of processing device which will carry out the instructions. So the kind of instructions Turing had in mind would be things like move the tape one step to the left, look at what's written in the resulting square. If it's a naught, turn it into a one. If it's a one, turn it into a naught. Move three spaces to the right, look at the next square that you find, and so on. And so a program, an algorithm for calculating things, a recipe for calculating things, would be a long list of very simple instructions. And what Turing showed very convincingly is anything that any kind of computational device can perform can be done by a Turing machine.
But it was the things that couldn't be done by a Turing machine that interested the young genius. And like Kurt Gödel before him, he was ready to shock his mathematical colleagues.
I show that certain large classes of numbers are computable,
he wrote in his now celebrated 1936 paper.
They include, for instance, the algebraic numbers and the numbers pi, e, etc. The computable numbers, however, do not include all definable numbers.
That was the crux of his paper, really. He proved that there were well-defined mathematical tasks that the universal Turing machine couldn't carry out. And as far as Turing was concerned at the time, that was his main result. Now, of course, from the modern perspective, it's just kind of a sideshow. The main thing about the 1936 paper is the modern computer.
The way people had thought about calculation before Turing had separated categories that he showed should not be separated, that they were really different ways of looking at the same stuff.
Logician Martin Davis has long been an advocate of Turing's theoretical work, and here he underlines how Turing's universal machine goes beyond dealing with numbers to handling any kind of data.
So that things that nowadays we take for granted, that word processing is a kind of computation, that manipulating a photographic image to get rid of red eye is a computational process. People didn't think that way at all in the 1930s. His proof that there exists in principle a single computational device that all by itself can be programmed to do any computation, that was a radical discovery. And the challenge to see if it could be practically implemented was just then sitting there on the table. Can we do this?
Alan Turing's prowess in pure mathematics overshadows his inclination to try things practically as well. When he went to the United States immediately after completing his 1936 paper to continue his studies there, he got his chance to address that question, can we do this?
One of the things that Turing did not that long after he wrote that paper when he was in Princeton, the Palmer Physics Laboratory on the campus is adjacent to the old Fine Hall building where the mathematics department was in those days. He would go over to the Palmer Physics Lab and borrow equipment and whatnot, and what he was doing was building a binary adder. He was always interested in practical matters.
Turing's interest in practical things was soon put to good use on his return to Britain. His war years at the code-breaking centre Bletchley Park now form the best-known part of his career. But then, and until long after his death, it was utterly secret. But no matter how familiar the story is now of Turing's role in breaking the German naval Enigma codes, Jack Copeland says it remains hard to grasp just how significant that work was.
Churchill's advisers were telling him in June 1941 that Britain was just a few months away from starvation. Britain absolutely depended on supplies that were coming across the North Atlantic from America and Canada. And the U-boats were sinking the ships. And they were sinking them so fast that Britain was in danger of being starved into defeat. If Turing hadn't broken U-boat Enigma, then the war might have gone very differently. It was in June 1941 that Turing and his team in Hut 8 at Bletchley Park began reading U-boat messages in real time. They were breaking the daily traffic. And the intelligence that they got from Turing's decrypts, Hut 8's decrypts, was so effective that for the first 23 days of June, the U-boats didn't sight a single convoy. It's a remarkable figure, I think. So Turing absolutely turned the balance of the war.
The bombs, as they were called, that crunched the German codes were largely mechanical machines with multitudinous cogged rotors turning and turning again as they tried to sort the German ciphers. But Bletchley Park later became home to Colossus, a giant number-crunching machine with 2,400 electronic valves switching on and off as they sifted different cipher keys. Turing wasn't involved with Colossus directly, but undoubtedly knew much about it, as his old Cambridge mentor Max Newman was in charge. All of this background would have been unknown to his colleagues at his next post after the war, the National Physical Laboratory on the outskirts of London.
Most of NPL didn't know that he'd been involved in this code-breaking work during the war. Nobody knew about it, nor would he ever speak to anybody about it.
Mike Woodger joined the National Physical Laboratory in May 1946, 8 months after Turing himself. As he explains in this recent recording for the NPL archive, the secrecy didn't extend as far as those who'd worked closely with Turing during the war and who knew what he could bring to the lab's big new project.
The people who knew were in the Secret Service and high up in government, and Walmersley was one of those who knew Alan Turing. So he persuaded Alan Turing to come to NPL when a new division was set up for numerical work. That was what they spoke of, because everyone could speak about numerical work. What they couldn't speak of was why Turing was so appropriate to lead a team doing that work. Moreover, his qualifications included experience of electronics. And again, nobody knew at that time that there was going to be an electronic computer. That was just not mentioned. Until 1946, the year I joined in May, in February, a complete description by Alan Turing was put before the executive committee of the NPL, and they approved it a month later to build an electronic computer.
This is Turing's design for the ACE. It's 48 pages long. It's finished by the end of 1945. And I think it's fair to describe this as the first relatively complete design for an electronic stored program computer.
There will be positively no internal alterations to be made. Even if we wish suddenly to switch from calculating the energy levels of the neon atom to the enumeration of groups of the order 720.
Turing wrote, extolling the virtues of a machine that could be programmed to do any calculation you specified.
It may appear somewhat puzzling that this can be done. How can one expect a machine to do all this multitudinous variety of things? The answer is quite simple. Namely, carrying out orders given to it in a standard form, which it is able to understand.
You know, he's got these many diagrams of the various hardware units. He's worked out exactly how the programming is going to work, and he even includes these programs in machine code, specimen programs. It's all there. So, you know, looking through this, you almost want to get your soldering iron out and start wiring it together.
Which was more or less Alan Turing's own inclination. Had bureaucracy and technical hold-ups not frustrated him, Alan Turing might now hold an uncontested place at the pinnacle of the history of computing. But they did, and as you can hear in next week's edition of Discovery, it was rivals in the north of England, associated with his old mentor Max Newman, who ran the first universal Turing machine. Not that Alan Turing was out of the game for long.
Shortly after the baby computer first ran on the 21st of June 1948, Turing had written a program himself to run on the baby machine.
The Manchester Baby, Pilot Ace and Modern Computing in next week's edition of Discovery from the BBC.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.